And now it even gives me greater pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Doug from Kahunga. Let's give him a round of applause and big welcome. Carl, we forgot the Doug R part. The R, R. You're on, Doug.
Thank you, Brenda. Yeah, you had like a 26-to-1 chance of just hitting any initial. My name is Doug Rao, and I am a grateful alcoholic. Grateful to be an alcoholic. Grateful to be an alcoholic, and grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sobriety date is June 7th, 1987. So I just turned 33 last month. So I'm about 33 years and 1 month and a couple of weeks. I don't know. Some people know how many days and seconds. I can figure it out, but it changes every day. Hard to keep track of. Norm Alpe used to say how many years and how many months he was sober, and he said, I don't know if that impresses you, it impresses the hell out of me, and I like to get it out there just in case this deal ever comes up with some kind of a pension plan. So happy birthday to the birthday people. That's great. I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I don't have some of the qualifications that other people have. You know, when you come here and they tell you, look for the similarities, not the differences, but we all start looking for the differences, you know, for trying to figure out how we can not be here. Oh, I'm not a real alcoholic. Gee, too bad. That would have been great. I was no rocket to stardom in this thing, I'll tell you. I don't come from an alcoholic family. My dad enjoyed a beer. You know, he would, Saturday afternoon, he might be working in the yard or working on his car or watching a football game or something. And then he would stop and have a beer and then go back to what he was doing, which I find that fascinating, you know, so because it's just not the way I drink. If I stop and have a beer, now that's what I'm doing. And whatever I was doing before couldn't have been very important, or why would I stop and have a beer? So I don't drink like my dad. My mom may have been an alcoholic. We never really could tell because she wouldn't drink. And, you know, if they don't drink, it's difficult to diagnose a case of alcoholism. Somebody won't swallow alcohol. I asked her one time. I was sober a while, and I asked my mom, why is it you don't ever drink? And she said, and it caught her off guard. Instead of giving me an answer, she said, why do you care? And I said, I was hoping to spare you this, but it seemed like there's such a thing as a genetic predisposition. So maybe your fault, I'm a drunk. I don't know. Why don't you drink? Are you an alcoholic? She said, am I an alcoholic? Have you ever seen me take a drink? I said, no, but I know hundreds of alcoholics that don't drink. So I mean, what's your deal? And she said, I don't know. When I was young and my friends drank, I would drink with them. But every time I drank, every time, I would get sick. I'd get stupid. I'd get obnoxious. So I just stopped. And I said, well, you got to drink through that, Mom. You know, the promised land lies beyond sick, stupid, and obnoxious. But I don't know. My mom didn't have the tenacity to make this program. I'm the oldest of four kids, the only boy. And if you asked any of my sisters, they would say I was the spoiled one in the family. Looking at it from in here, it didn't seem that way, but they all seem to agree, so I'm outnumbered. It wasn't an alcoholic family. We were a happy family, hardworking family. We sang together, you know, just for fun, not professionally or anything. And my wife Carla likes to point out in her talk, my dad painted our family pickup truck my high school colors. Yeah, we were that family. And I really sort of don't care about drinking. And maybe I wouldn't have drank. I never had a drink till I was 18, so I didn't start too young. But maybe I never would have drank, except that my friend Morris, who was, he was a little more advanced. He was like a sex sponsor, you know. Morris was a little, he was the one that would give us guidance on matters sexual. And Morris said to me, Doug, if you want to get a home run with this girl, you're going to have to get her drunk, man. And because we used to use these baseball terms, you know, we had like, there was a first base and a second base and a third base. And then, of course, the home run is pretty obvious. I don't remember where the bases are now. Seemed like there's not enough bases. And besides that, I'm married a long time. It's like step up to the plate and slide home. But but at the time, the steps, you know, the bases were real important. And Morris said, if you want to get a home run with her, you're going to have to get her drunk. So I heard that. So that changed my attitude about drinking. I grew up in Garden Grove, California. And there was a liquor store on Garden Grove Boulevard that used to, all the guys knew that they kept their back door open, and probably so they could take stuff out to the dumpster or something. But so we knew that we could run in the back door and steal a bottle occasionally. So I ran in the back door and I grabbed a quart of Rainier Ale and split out the back door. And so now this girl and I went and parked by the railroad tracks, and we had parked there before. This wasn't the first time. But this time I got my ammunition, you know, and I still didn't care about drinking. I would have been happy to say, here, drink this and let me know when you're ready. But it just seemed kind of rude. So I pulled it out from under the seat and I cracked the top on that bottle and had my first drink of Rainier Ale. And as I recall, it tasted like carbonated dishwater. And so, but I wasn't there for the taste. So I handed it to her and she drank some and handed it back. And we passed this bottle back and forth and killed it in about 5 minutes. And then gradually I got this feeling that I don't know if non-alcoholics get that feeling. Maybe they get that feeling and it feels good, but they don't want too much of it. I don't know what they do, but what I did was I felt warm and friendly and mostly cool. And I knew what cool was. And you know, cool is just one of the very few words that has run the generations. The flappers had cool, and the greatest generation, and the beatniks, and the hippies, and the mods and rockers, and the Gen X's, and the millennials. Everybody knows what cool is, because cool is cool. And I knew I wasn't. But that night, I knew I was. Not only that, I knew anybody who looked at me would know I was cool. That's how cool I was. And so was she. And I felt very sexy, and so did she. So this is the first time I ever had an alcohol buzz. And the first time I ever had sex in front of a witness. So I was like, oh, I'm going to do both of these things as much as I can the rest of my life, man. You know, we talk about commitment in AA. That's a commitment. And I had started playing guitar, so I went out and started making money playing music. First acoustic guitar, playing the folk houses, the coffee houses, as they called them. Not Starbucks for you younger people. This is like coffee houses in the 60s were like dimly lit performance venues, you know, where comedians would come and singers would come. And the music of the day was the Kingston Trio and Peter, Paul, and Mary. That was in 63. But in 64, the Beatles came to town and they brought the whole British invasion, the Rolling Stones and the Animals and the Yardbirds and Cream. And it just changed the face of music, of popular music. And I got an electric guitar. I started playing in bands. And then was playing in bands in Orange County, and I was still underage, and there was two of us in this four-piece band that were underage, so every once in a while the ABC would come in, check IDs, and they'd shut the bar down. So we had to keep changing the name of the band because people wouldn't hire us because they were afraid they're going to get the, their bar shut down. So finally I decided I need to move to Hollywood, man. So I moved. Hollywood's about 60 miles north of where I grew up in Orange County. And I moved up there, and a friend of mine from high school was living, he was a musician, he was living in Laurel Canyon, and he and his roommate invited me in. So the three of us were living in this little two-bedroom house in Laurel Canyon. And Laurel Canyon was the place to be in 1969. Man, it was just, there was musicians all over the place. Everybody we knew was a musician, and studio musicians, and bar musicians, and recording musicians. And so I got in this band called The Rock Wall. We played all up and down Hollywood Boulevard and Sunset Boulevard and Santa Monica Boulevard. You know, we'd go in there, people would buy us drinks all night long. And, you know, hey man, you know, hand us a joint or something, you know, go out back, get it on. But what happened was right about that time, a show came to town, a Broadway musical called Hair. Now, I love Broadway musicals, I do. Not the kind of music I like to play normally, but Oklahoma and the Music Man and the Sound of Music, very cool, you know? People are up on stage falling in love and they start holding hands and singing down the street and the whole neighborhood joins them and everybody's singing and dancing. I love that shit. So, but Hair was a whole different deal. Hair was about hippies. And they were having sex on stage or appearing to have sex on stage. They were smoking dope. They were, it was drugs and sex and rock and roll. And hell no, we won't go, you know? And so I went to see this show and I fell in love with it. So the next day I called the theater and I said, she said, Aquarius Theater, can I help you? I said, yeah, I want to be in your show. She said, just a minute, I'll connect you. Now, I don't think this can happen today. I think today they would say, who is your agent? And please have your representative contact us. Perhaps we can set up some. This was 1969, was just different. They were hiring people off the street. And so they said, they connected me to the company manager and I told him I want to be in the show. And he said, can you sing and dance? And I said, that's what I do, brother. That's how I put gas in my car. That's how I pay my rent. Yeah, I sing and dance. Now, I sang every night. We sang 5 hours a night, but I never danced a step in my life. I'm up on stage watching you dance. Good dancing, bad dancing. How hard can it be? So I said, yeah, sing and dance. That's what I do. So he said, what are you doing Friday at 1 o'clock? I said, you tell me. He said, Friday at 1 o'clock, we're having auditions. What's your name? I told him. What's your phone number? I told him. He said, bring a piece of sheet music you like to sing. We'll give you an audition. So I went right down to Wallach Music City and got a piece of sheet music. Went to work that night. I told him, let me sing this song a few times. I got to practice because I'm auditioning for Hair on Friday. So I did. I sang it a couple times Wednesday night and a couple times Thursday night. And Friday morning, I got my guitar out, practicing the song, and I broke a string, and I'm like, hippies were like, oh, bad karma, dude. So I went into my roommate's room to see if he had the D string that I broke. And right in the middle of his messed up dresser was a little envelope that said D string on it. You know, we're like, oh, good karma, dude. So, but underneath the envelope was a little white capsule. And I thought, I wonder what that is. Nope. Because we didn't have a PDR. You pretty much had to swallow test everything. And this turned out to be THC, synthetic marijuana. So when I got down to the Aquarius Theater, I went in and they called my name and I went up on stage, handed the sheet music to the piano player. He starts to play and I start singing, wow, I feel good. And I went into this James Brown number and I thought I was the godfather of soul. And I'm on my knees and I'm back up and when I hold you. So good, so good. I got you. Bum, 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 bum. Wow. And people who were judging the auditioners are going, looking at each other, and this guy says, "Brother, we like your energy. Can you do something a little mellower for us, so we kind of get a range of what you can do?" And I said, "Yeah, no problem." So I went into this a cappella version of Otis Redding's Dock of the Bay, and the piano player knew the tune, and he picked it up right in my key. Oh, you were right in the pocket, man. "Looks like nothing gonna change. Everything still remains the same." I made myself cry. And they said, "We're great, man. We love you. Just got to see you dance." Shit, I forgot I couldn't dance. The guy started to play, and I started to move. And I suspect, initially, I looked like a combination of Joe Cocker and Julie Louis Dreyfus, you know, sort of a, but my hair was long and came around. I was getting trails off of my hair, and I had this fringe vest on, 6 layers of red, white, and blue leather fringe. So I'm just moving to the music, and I'm in this tornado of trails, and I heard somebody say, "Jesus, can he dance?" I said, "I thought so." So they hired me, but I thought I was auditioning for the Las Vegas show. I mean, for the Hollywood show, but they were auditioning for Las Vegas. They said, "Can you be in Las Vegas next Tuesday afternoon?" And I said, "Yes, yes." I had to play the weekend, but I could tell my band, "You need to get another bass player." It wasn't hard to find a singing bass player. Everybody we knew was musicians. I told my roommates, "Got to get another roommate." They said, "Cool." Everybody wanted to live in Laurel Canyon. That was no problem. I had to find a home for my dog, and little Vietnamese restaurant said they would be happy to take him. So Tuesday morning, I jumped on my motorcycle and ate a tab of Orange Sunshine and headed out for Las Vegas. And I got there and I learned the show in 2 or 3 days. And we played Vegas for 6 months, and it was fun. It was a fun job, but we were about the only hippies in Las Vegas in 1970. You know, the cops didn't really like hippies there. And most of the people in Vegas at that time, you know, were cravats and, you know, nice sparkly suits and stuff. And we were just a bunch of ratty hippies, but we did a show, you know, and we did 8 shows a week. But when we left Las Vegas after 6 months, we became the first national tour of AIR. And we traveled around the United States and Canada for 3.5 years, 2 weeks here, 3 weeks there. And they gave me the lead role, Burger, the obnoxious speed freak, sex crazed leader of the tribe. It was a great job, man. People would come up on stage after and say, "Listen, we own a bar up the street. You guys like to drink? You can come and drink for free all night. Oh, we'll be there. Here, you like pot, Sinsamia, Malu Awe, Panama Red, Acapulco Gold, give us all this great dope, because we can sing and dance. I don't know. Just say thanks. You like acid, Osley, Purple Haze, Orange Sunshine, Window Pane, nay, nay, nay." Some girl would come up, "Oh my God, I love you. Take me." Okay. And so it's like sex, drugs, rock and roll, traveling around the country at union scale. It was a good job. By the time it ended 3.5 years later, I had hooked up with a girl in the show, and she got pregnant, and we had a little baby, and we came back to LA, and she went to work doing office temp work, supporting us. And I went down to Goodwill and bought a car seat and welded brackets on it for my Harley. So I would tool around Hollywood with my 1-year-old daughter in a diaper in this car seat on the back of my scooter. And I would go visit friends and go to auditions and sit in bars and cheat on her mother. I thought I was a good parent because I took care of my daughter during the day. But I wasn't a good parent. I put her in so much risk. And I was a worse husband. I was a horrible husband. And finally, her mother just said, "Look, I know you love your daughter. She loves you. Stay in her life. But get the fuck out of mine. You know, just, I don't need you here. I need you somewhere else." So I left. But I did stay in my daughter's life. And when my wife was at work, or when her mother was at work, I would go pick her up after school, when she started school, and keep her with me until her mom got home from work. And then, and I would just, you know, and I got a job as a stage hand, a prop man on TV. And I started out with a good reputation because I was young and strong and smart, and I had theater background. So I knew what I was doing. But the longer I drank and used, the more that reputation started to hit the skids. And I would break things while they were taping a show, you know, or I would fall asleep and miss a cue. Or sometimes I just wouldn't show up because I was too loaded. And I started to just really lose it. And I started to hurt myself. I skied off a cliff up at Mammoth, 50-foot cliff. Wasn't an accident either. I thought I could do it because it was right after the Winter Olympics. They jump 170 meters or something like that. 50-foot cliff, big deal. It's not a big deal for them, but if you don't know how to, if you land upside down like I did with your skis on top and your head on the bottom, you can get hurt, and I did. I broke my shoulder, and I had to have my shoulder operated on, and I was out of work for 6 weeks. Then when I got back to work maybe a month, somebody had a party, and it lasted all night, Friday night. And in the morning, this girl and I decided to go get eggs to make breakfast. And on the way, it was such a beautiful April morning, we thought we should make love in the great outdoors. And I don't know if you're familiar with downtown Burbank, but it's not a place with a lot of outdoor lovemaking venues. You know, the city of Burbank, I guess they frown on that, but they don't provide lovemaking venues, I tell you that. We found a four-story parking structure. Long story short, I fell off of it, and I had a 0.40 blood alcohol level. The reason I know that is because this was the parking structure of St. Joseph's Hospital. So when I fell 54 feet straight down, landed on my feet, but my knees buckled, and I kicked myself in the ass and broke my pelvis in two places, and snapped the heel bone off my right foot, shoved it to my foot like a bowling ball, excuse me, and broke all the little bones. It didn't break the skin on my foot, but my foot turned into a swollen bag of bones that looked like a tetherball with toes. And I was in there for 10 days while they tried to figure out how to put my foot back together. And I got out of there. And my friend Teddy, who was my fun drinking partner, man, anytime I wanted to just go out and party, I would call Teddy, "What are you doing?" She'd say, "What do you got in mind?" "Let's go get drunk and be somebody." So we'd go hit the road, jump on that scooter and go drink and use. And Teddy was fun to be with. However, you knew if you went drinking with Ted, there's a good chance you're going to end up in a fight or in handcuffs. But it's worth it because she was just so much fun. So, anyway, but what happened was I fell off this building and Teddy hit bottom. And I don't know how that works, but everybody who loved Teddy would say, "Have you seen her? I can't believe it. She turned from this crazy drunk woman into a lady in every sense of the word in less than 2 weeks." She would, if she said she was going to be somewhere, she'd be there, dressed appropriately, speaking in whole sentences. And the only thing wrong with it, we were all happy for her because we knew she was going to die if she kept drinking. But every time you talked to her, she'd say things like meetings and big books and steps and sponsors. And finally, I told her, "Hey, Teddy, shut up, okay? Shut up. I don't know if you're trying to draft me into your deal or what, but I'll tell you this. If I ever see alcohol interfering with my life, I probably will go to AA." And she said, "Oh my God, Doug, how many jobs have you lost drunk? How many times have you been told not to come to your daughter's house drunk anymore? You fell off a four-story building. You skied off a cliff, drunk. What would you call interference? Brain death?" And I said, "I see where you're going with this, but I don't think accidents should count. Anybody fall off a four-story building is gonna get hurt. So you're getting alcoholism mixed up with gravity, sweetheart. And she was just, oh my God, I can't believe, okay, I'm out of here. And she left. But all that week, every time I'd have a little quiet moment, I would picture Teddy's face saying, what would you call interference, Doug? Brain death? Brain death? And I thought, brain death is on the table for me. The two accidents I told you about could have ended in brain death if I landed differently. Another two or three that I didn't mention also could have, and the next one very well may, and there will be a next one. And I thought, if I keep drinking, I could end up in a wheelchair or a bed the rest of my life, unable to feed myself or go to the bathroom by myself and know it. And I could hardly think of a scarier situation today. So it scared me so bad, I rushed right down to AA. Somebody told me, you want to go to AA, go to a big speaker meeting, they'll leave you alone. That's bullshit. They don't, we don't stay sober leaving new people alone. That was my first AA lie. So I went to this big speaker meeting in Van Nuys at Valley Presbyterian Hospital. And I went in there and got there early, and I'm watching people set up chairs and make coffee and set up the literature, and they're hugging and laughing. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, this, I can't believe this. And I knew these people used to drink like me, but something happened to them. You know, they turned like Teddy. And so I'm just leaned against the wall looking irritated so nobody will talk to me. But people did. Hey, you're new. I'd say, no, I'm not, beat it. And most of them did. One guy, Hank, comes up. He goes, you're new. I said, no, I'm not. And he said, oh, I haven't seen you here before. What's your name? My name is Doug, and you haven't seen me here before because I've never been here before. So, mystery solved. Take a hike. And he goes, oh, that's what we mean, man. New. You're new to us. You know, never been here. That's new, right? Okay. I'm new like I've never been here, but I'm not new like a new member. I'm not a joiner. I'm a loner. I'm an outlaw, dude. I'm a desperado, okay? I'm a misfit. I'm a misfit, man. I never fit any place in my life. I didn't fit in school. I don't really fit in the workplace. I barely fit in my own goddamn family. I'm certainly not going to fit here in Alcoholics Anonymous, for Christ's sake. Hug, hug. Laugh, isn't it good? We're not drinking. I'm sorry, man. This is not my room. I'm just here checking it out, okay? I'm visiting. I'm observing. I'm auditing the class, brother. That's all. So just leave me over here against the wall. I'll be fine. I like drinking. I don't want to stop. I drank on the way here. So here, how about this? I absolutely intend to drink on the way home, no matter what happens here. So I'm pretty sure I'm not your target market. Why don't you go help somebody else? And you know what he said? Ah, I like you. You're gonna fit right in, man. And I thought, God, could I have been any more articulate about how I'm not gonna fit in? But he was right, of course. If somebody said to me what I told you I said to him, I would say the same thing. Oh yeah, you're in, man. You might as well grab a chair, you know, put your keys on it, because ooga booga, one of us, brother. But I didn't understand that. And another guy came in, me and this other old hippie, he's leaning against the wall on the other side of the double doors, and I'm leaning against the wall on this side. And people are sitting down, or both of us are standing in the back of the room. And I thought, you know what we are, is the cool section here. Everybody else here is Squaresville. Me and this other guy are cool. We're so cool, we didn't even talk to each other. We're like, hey, dude. And they started the meeting and they read stuff, you know, like we did tonight. And and then the secretary said, we have a birthday tonight for Ruth for 18 years. And I thought, that is so cool. I didn't know that they celebrated birthdays. And so I'm looking around for Ruth, some 18-year-old tiny hiney, and Ruth is walking towards the front of the room, and she's 50, if she's a day. So I thought, God damn, man, if she's 18, she really should stop drinking tonight. And But she didn't look bad, you know. She looked good. She's all dressed up and made up. Wow. She's taking her cake. But I didn't know anything about that. So I get it. This is AA. They don't drink here. I bet you Ruth hadn't had a drink in 18 years. Oh, my God, 18 years. I wonder if that's a national record. And I thought, well, happy birthday, Ruth. I cued the choir. I didn't know. All of a sudden, 200 people started singing, happy birthday. 200 people singing happy birthday in four different keys at the same time. And many of these people were not even committed to the key they started in. I'm a musician. This did not go unnoticed by me. I'm like, God damn, there's a piano on stage. Why don't somebody get on there and get everybody in the same key? But Ruth gets up and she says, blows out her candles. My name's Ruth and I'm an alcoholic. And of course, everybody goes, hi, Ruth. Oh my God, this is some level of lameness I never knew was available to me. And so Ruth says, I want you to know that over these last 18 years, I have attended a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. And that's what I contribute my sobriety to. And I thought, every day for 18 years, you're a little slow, aren't you, Ruth? You are not the sharpest knife in the drawer, honey, because I don't know if I want this thing. But I'll tell you this, if I decide I want it, it's not going to take me every day for 18 years. I'm a quick study. I'm like, hum a few bars and I'll fake it kind of guy. But I was so amused by this. I looked over at the other cool guy, who was not that cool because he was singing with him. And I see he's heading over to me. Now I know this guy is a member. I don't know why he's standing at the back of the room. Maybe he's got the newcomer catcher commitment or something. But anyway, he's heading over to me and he grabs my hand and he said, hey man, I'll tell you what, you stay sober a year, we'll give you one of them cakes. 1 year. Oh, really? You're kidding me. If I don't drink for a year, I get a cake? Woo! Woo! Oh, this is the big one. I'm coming, Elizabeth. I get my own cake. You know, I was so shocked, I couldn't even make fun of him. I just said, I'm not much of a pastry eater, pal, but if I wanted a cake, I'd just stop at Vaughn's on the way home. You know, I think they're like $5, you know, or I could not drink for a year. But one thing that happened at that meeting is the secretary held up this book, and she said, this is our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the basic text of our program, the only authority on AA. If you're new tonight, please don't leave without this book. I thought, okay, we established that I'm new, so I will steal the book. She said, we sell it at our cost. And I thought, not to me, bitch. I'm taking the thing. I'm going to act like I'm fascinated walking out the door. And I think, and I really had the feeling, if they even noticed that I was doing that, they'd say, let them go. I could hardly wait to try it. The worst case would happen, either I'd have to buy the book or give it back. You know, what are they going to do, put me in jail? So I could hardly wait for the meeting to be over. But then she screwed it up. She said, if you're new tonight and you're financially embarrassed, we understand that. We've been there. We want you to have the book. We'll make very liberal credit arrangements, including nothing down and nothing a week until you get back on your feet. Back on your feet. Now, if I steal the book, you're going to think I'm homeless. So I have my pride. I will steal from you, but I will not accept your goddamn charity. So now I got to wait till the end of the meeting, and I go up to her and I say, excuse me, ma'am, can I buy one of your books? She said, oh, the big book? Yeah, the big book. I've seen bigger. How much is that big book? She said, it's $4.65. Do you have it? I figured it's probably $20, $25. It's a hardcover book. with a dust jacket on it. It's $4.65. Yeah, I think I can handle that. Here's a five, keep the change. So now I got my book. Oh no, so I'll give you change back. No, lady, keep the change. Use that change to help a drunk because I'm on my feet, okay? So I got my book, and on the way home, I got a bottle of whiskey. And I came home and I poured three fingers of whiskey and I sat down with this book. I didn't stay up all night studying the big book. I don't have to. I have the ability to look at the title of a chapter, almost any book, and pretty much know everything in the chapter. It's a gift that I have. So, doctor's opinion, I've had doctor's opinions. Chapter one, Bill's story. Who cares? Chapter two, there's a solution. That's a sales pitch. Young man, there's a solution to your problem. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous will give you a life beyond your wildest drunken dream. Great. Chapter three, more about alcoholism. I thought, oh, this could actually be the most boring piece of literature in the English language. So I'm skipping that one. I haven't been reading for 2 minutes and I'm already up to chapter four. We agnostics. We agnostics. When I went to my first meeting, now see, I forgot to tell you, my grandmother, my mother's mother, was a drunk. And I never knew her when she was a drunk. And when I was about six, she found Jesus and picked up the cross and dedicated her life to Christ, stopped smoking and drinking, and she opened a Skid Row mission in San Pedro and spent the last 37 years of her life doing what we do, trust God, clean house, help others. But she hated AA. She was all about love, except she hated AA. And I could probably figure out why. I never asked her why. But because she hated AA, I thought there was no God here. You come in here, my higher power, power greater than yourself, humbly asked him with a capital H, admitted to God, prayed to God, told God, oh my God, God, the last house on the block is Sunday school. Jeez, no! And, but here was this big book, The Only Authority on AA, has a whole chapter called We Agnostics. So, this is how the smart people stay sober without God. So I poured another three fingers of whiskey and I read that whole chapter. And I finished it. I thought, I have absolutely no idea what I just read. Because I'm looking for how the smart people stay sober without God. And I promise you, that is not in that chapter. If anything, it's the opposite. You know, in fact, in the first paragraph, which I evidently skipped, because it's pretty clear, says, if when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit drinking entirely, or once you start, you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably an alcoholic. And if this be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Yeah. Where's the smart people part? You know, so I poured some more whiskey and I read this chapter again. And this time, I had a little more focus on the black part, the print. And there's one sentence that jumped off the page at me. It says, we found that God does not make too hard terms on those who seek him. And when I realized what that said, I thought I knew something about religions of the world, Western and Eastern. And I never heard anybody say anywhere, we don't think God makes hard terms. It seemed to me every religion I thought I knew about, my drunken opinion of organized religion, by the way, was that every religion and every sect of every religion had their principles, their requirements, hoops you had to jump through, and they were different from each sect, and they're wrong and we're right. And so the answer is either one is right, the rest are wrong, or they're all wrong, which made more sense to me. But my grandmother's Pentecostal church never said, we think God doesn't make hard terms. If anything, it seemed like they said the opposite. They say, you know, they call me, you know, we are very sure that God makes hard times on those who seek him. Boy, you know, God will not even hear your prayers unless you're baptized. And I don't mean sprinkle on the forehead like some Methodist. I'm talking about total submission. Total submission, boy. That's why we got a tank of water for Christ up here. Come on up, son. We're going to salt you down, pull you up, washed in the blood of the Lamb. Praise Jesus. Oh, man. Somebody get that boy a towel. You know, I'm like 14. I rode there on my bicycle. I'm going to save your towel, man. I ain't get wet in this room because I don't know if my grandmother told him I touched myself or what, but I could just imagine Brother Van Dyke saying the next day, I tell you what, I'm going to miss that boy's guitar playing, but thank God he don't have to abuse himself no more. And I'm just saying, you know what? I got brand new Levi's on, man, straight to fit. I get in that tank, I won't be able to ride my bike home. I'll be back with something more water soluble. Man, I'm out of there. But it wasn't just the Pentecostals. My girlfriend was Catholic. She had to go to confession, communion, confirmation, a bunch of other cons to determine how many Hail Marys and Our Fathers would cleanse her soul of the various kinds of sins. Because you know Catholics, I know we got Catholics here. Validate me. Catholics don't have sin. They got them categorized, venial, menial, cardinal, mortal. Some of them, you don't have to do them if you think about them. Expressway to hell, pal. Really, you could burn in perdition for eternity. Thinking about sin, that's not going to work for me. And then my friend Michael was an Orthodox Jew. He and his brother Sherm had to wear spit curls to school. Oh, there's a loving God for you. Send kids to public school with spit curls. So, I don't know. I go over to Michael's house for dinner. His mom says, Doug, welcome to our home. It's an honor to have you. Would you like to join us in some wine and challah? I'm sorry, some what? Would you like to join the family in some wine and challah? Well, have some wine. I'm not much of a pastry eater, Mrs. Stein. You know, and then there were Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims. Oh, my. So by the time I got to AA, I'm like, here's the line. All the religions over there, I'll be over here making fun of you. And I started going to AA, and I was going to different meetings every day. I wanted to get an overview of Alcoholics Anonymous without anybody getting to know me. You know, and I didn't, like I said, I wasn't a rocket to stardom. My first 8 months, I didn't have a home group or a sponsor. I didn't read the book, didn't take the steps. 8 months, I didn't have a commitment anywhere. I didn't know what a tradition was. I didn't believe in God, and I was drinking every day. Except for that, I had a pretty good program, which was keep coming back. It's the only thing I did right for 8 months. Only thing I did right. And eventually, I came home from a meeting and fell on my knees and asked God for help. I came home, I had a bottle of whiskey with me, and I fell on my knees accidentally, and I spilled the whiskey all over the bed, and I put the bottle in a safe place, grabbed the bedspread, started sucking whiskey out of the bedspread, and a voice in my head said, "Hey, man, that ain't right." And I'm like, "What? You thirsty? There's whiskey in the bottle, brother." I'm like, "I'm not thirsty, I'm frugal. I'll waste my life, but I'm not letting the whiskey evaporate in the bedspread overnight." And I saw myself on my knees sucking whiskey out of a bottle, out of a bedspread. And I said, "God, if you're there, please help me." And over the next couple of weeks, I got a series of, miracles or coincidences. I don't know if there's any difference, but I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. My daughter, who I disappointed time after time after time, told me a couple of years ago on my 30th AA birthday, "You know, Dad, I always thought of you as the fun parent, but I realize today you're the one who was always there for me." And I certainly wasn't. The first 15 years of her life, I wasn't. But the last 30, I have been. So that's the way it seemed to her. And her mother was always there for her, and her stepfather, and both of our families. When my father was on his deathbed, I held his hand and I said, "Dad, everything good about me came from you." And he said, "That is not true." I said, "It is true. You're the one who taught me how to be a father, how to be a son, how to be a brother, how to be a husband, how to be a neighbor. Everything good about me I got from you." And he said, "Well, you have AA. And he was right. Everything he wanted to teach me, I learned, but I couldn't put it into practice until I came to you and you took me through those 12 steps. And I somewhere along the line developed integrity, honesty, love, and faith. I have AA. Thank you for that. And thanks for letting me share. Thank you.
Let's give Doug another round of applause. Thank you so much.